You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm really happy to be kicking off this new podcast with the Santa Fe, New Mexican. The New Mexican is a terrific paper with great reporters, and it's the kind of paper that barely exists anymore in the United States. It's a high-quality, independent, local newspaper, and I'm really happy that the New Mexican and the Radio Cafe are joining forces. We're going to be on twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, but of course you can listen anytime. That's the beauty of podcasting. You can listen both through the newspaper's website and at radiocafe.org. We're going to be doing shows on all kinds of topics, local, national, serious, and fun. One series I have planned is about our own government, what's working, what's not working, and what can citizens do to make it better. This was inspired by the fact that so many people, including me, have been getting demoralized by a system that seems broken in so many ways. All the realities of corruption and money and the feeling of powerlessness to do anything about it. This series challenges that powerlessness by presenting people who are actively looking at problems in a historical context and in the present day, people who are fighting for a world that upholds the democratic principles on which our country was founded, even if imperfectly. They're fighting in many specific on-the-ground ways, which you will be hearing about. We're also going to be doing lots of other shows, arts, sciences, movies, and lots of local New Mexican awesomeness. We want to hear your feedback, so please email us at feedback@radiocafe.org if you have any ideas, comments, or questions. In just a moment, we're going to go to a conversation with Ari Berman. He is an award-winning journalist who's written for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, The Nation, The Guardian, and he's a frequent commentator on MSNBC and NPR. His most recent book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. The book is a history of the Voting Rights Act, the VRA, a landmark law passed in 1965 that transformed the United States by ending many forms of voter discrimination and bringing people who had previously been disenfranchised into the democratic process. As you will hear, the pushback against this law has gone on for decades, and in 2013, the United States Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the law, rendering it pretty much toothless and ushering in a new era of voter discrimination. But that's not the end of the story. Ari Berman, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Your book, Give Us the Ballot, is a vivid history of the Voting Rights Act from 1965 to the present. And in many ways, it's a history of some of the central conflicts in our society. The exclusion of so many citizens from voting that gave rise to the Voting Rights Act, and then the backlash to it, which is what your book covers, echoes another period in our history, the Civil War and then Reconstruction. Can you quickly kind of give us a sense of the progress that was made for ex-slaves right after the Civil War and then the backlash that shut it down?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there's this kind of strange contradiction, which is that we passed three amendments to the Constitution after the Civil War, the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendment, to try to make the promise of Reconstruction real and to really try to end the Civil War and to give rights to newly freed African Americans. And so the 15th Amendment in particular says that the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And that language had the effect of giving the right to vote to black men. At that point, of course, black women and all other women could not vote until the 19th Amendment was passed in 1920. So there is this brief period after the passage of the 15th Amendment where there is a multiracial integrated democracy in the South for the first time. You have black senators and governors from states like Louisiana and Mississippi, something that we've never actually seen since. And you have whites voting for black candidates, and you have blacks voting for progressive white candidates. So there's kind of this golden age of multiracial democracy in the South. And that prompts a fierce backlash from white conservatives, from former and current segregationists, who try to use any means necessary to overthrow Reconstruction. And what happens is there's a disputed election in 1876, and Rutherford B. Hayes needs the votes of a few southern states to be able to be elected president. And so he pledges to pull federal troops out of the South. And after federal troops are pulled out of the South, you begin to see things like poll taxes and literacy tests and all the other things that we think of as Jim Crow, backed up by widespread violence. There are lynchings across the South, outright fraud, and this brief period of multiracial democracy that we think of as Reconstruction comes to really a complete halt. And instead, we see Jim Crow basically last from however you want to date it, the 1880s, the 1890s, all the way up through until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965.
And as you write about people like Rosa Parks tried to register over and over, and what she was denied, everybody was denied, literacy tests, poll taxes. And then in 1965, President Lyndon Johnson had just signed the Civil Rights Act and initially wasn't ready to go for another big piece of legislation, the Voting Rights Act. What happened then?
So Johnson gets in and he begins the effort to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that's really a bill to desegregate all sorts of institutions, to desegregate schools and to desegregate public places and all of those things. And that's very, very important. But Johnson expends a lot of political capital on passing the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so in December of 1964, Martin Luther King goes to the White House. He's just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he tells LBJ that he's going to Selma, Alabama, to push for the Voting Rights Act, because Selma was a place where only 2% of African Americans were registered to vote. And it was really indicative of the fact that so many people were disenfranchised across the Jim Crow South. And so King tells LBJ, I'm going to Selma to push for the Voting Rights Act. And LBJ basically says, I support the Voting Rights Act, support doing something on voting rights, but it's not going to happen now. I just passed the Civil Rights Act. We're not going to get to this for another few years. We have to do all this other stuff, my Great Society legislation, which is, you know, Medicare and all of this other stuff. And so the idea is that voting and the Voting Rights Act in particular is going to take some time. But King really goes to Selma to force LBJ's hand. And there's this really pivotal march called Bloody Sunday on March 7th, 1965, when John Lewis, who's now a member of Congress, and about 800 other civil rights activists attempt to march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. They are brutally beaten. The entire country sees this footage. And that leads LBJ to dramatically expedite his timetable for voting rights. And so what happens is 8 days after the Bloody Sunday march, LBJ introduces the Voting Rights Act before a joint session of Congress on March 15th, 1965. And then in August, so basically just about 6 months later, the Voting Rights Act is signed into law.
You just said a moment ago something which is kind of shocking, like 2% of the African-American residents of Selma, Alabama were registered to vote. Numbers like that were true all over the South. The Voting Rights Act then came in, and it's a very powerful piece of legislation. What did it do, and how was it enforced?
It was a tremendously powerful piece of legislation. It really transformed areas like Selma, Alabama, and the South more broadly, and then, you know, America even more broadly, basically overnight, because what it did is it struck down all the different voter suppression devices that had prevented people from registering. It got rid of the literacy tests and poll taxes and all those related devices literally overnight. And then it led to a massive increase in voter registration, first by knocking down those barriers, secondly by sending federal officials to the South immediately to the worst jurisdictions to register voters, and then just making it easier to register vote more broadly led to a massive increase. So, I mean, in Selma, Alabama alone, the number of black registered voters increased by 65% in one day, which is just kind of unbelievable. And then eventually in places like Alabama and Mississippi and all across the rest of the South, black voter registration basically equaled white voter registration. And the way that the Voting Rights Act was enforced was both by federal officials going to the South and actually enforcing the law on the ground, but also over a longer period of time. What the Voting Rights Act did is it required those states with the longest histories of discrimination to approve their voting changes with the federal government, because Congress and LBJ knew full well that once you struck down a literacy test or a poll tax in Alabama or Mississippi or Texas or Georgia, they were just going to try to come up with another one. And so the fact that these states had to approve their voting changes with the federal government allowed the federal government to block voting discrimination and block new voter suppression tactics before they ever became law. And that's eventually the part of the law that the Supreme Court struck down in 2013, which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Yeah, indeed. The success of the Voting Rights Act and its enforcement, as you're talking about, depended on the commitment of people in the federal government and also the cooperation of local officials. Was that difficult? What did it look like?
It was difficult. I mean, a lot of these states were very resistant to the idea of the Voting Rights Act and to voting rights for African Americans more broadly. And so that's why the federal government had to go in there. That's why the Voting Rights Act was so necessary in the first place. I mean, basically the idea was that if federal officials went to a few really bad places in the South to begin registering voters, that would be an incentive to other people in the South to start registering black voters, or else the federal government would come to their town as well. And nobody wanted to be the town that the federal government was occupying again. Everyone was kind of cognizant about the Civil War, and the people that passed the Voting Rights Act didn't want to really become an occupation force, and the South didn't really want that to happen again. So actually, there was a lot of resistance to the Voting Rights Act from the southern states, but there's also at the local level a lot of compliance almost immediately, where people realized that if they didn't comply with the law, that suddenly the federal government was going to show up and they were going to have power to register voters themselves. And so that kind of incentivized good behavior among states and localities.
One of the really important things about the Voting Rights Act is that it's not just about the right to vote. It's about political power and representation of previously unrepresented people. What did that look like? How did that change after 1965 and in the immediately following years?
Well, that's a good point. Initially, the Voting Rights Act was aimed at striking down all of the barriers to people actually being able to vote, first to be able to register to vote and then to be able to vote itself. And then once people began getting registered in large numbers and voting for large numbers, the question was, well, what are we voting for? What kind of representation are we going to have? And so the fight over the Voting Rights Act moved from just, you know, straight up access to registration, access to voting, to broader notions of access to representation. And what African American voters and others argued, who had been shut out for a long time, was wasn't just enough for them to be able to register to vote or to vote. They actually had to have the ability to elect their preferred representative so they could actually have some power in local communities. And this became a very contentious thing, because in a lot of places in the South, there were very gerrymandered districts. There were election systems that made it virtually impossible for African Americans to be elected. And it took a long time to dismantle those mechanisms. It was one thing to get people to register to vote. It was a whole nother thing for politicians to give up the kind of discriminatory apparatus that they had set up to hold power for so many years. And that's really, I think, why the Voting Rights Act was so important, because it did shift power in very tangible ways. But that was not without controversy.
And it was so difficult because, I mean, every time somebody tried to run for even like school board, there were manipulations that happened. So you could have a town that was 40% black, 60% white, and no black school board members.
Yep, exactly. I mean, this is one of the things that happened all across the South, and not even just the South, but all across the country, is you'd have things, for example, like at-large elections, which nobody really thinks about or knows anything about. But as you mentioned, you can have a situation where if a town is 40% black and 60% white, and there are a lot of Southern towns like this, and all of the elections are done on a citywide or a countywide basis, and whites refuse to vote for black candidates, that means that the 60% white majority can elect everybody, that there will be no black candidates. And so one of the things that the Voting Rights Act did was people tried to push for at least individual districts So there could be some basic level of representation. So yeah, if you had a town that was 60% white and 40% black, that if you had a 5-member city council, maybe there would at least be 1 or 2 African Americans on the council. And that wouldn't change everything in the place, but it would allow some basic representation for the first time. And so that those kind of things took a very, very long time to dismantle. It wasn't until the 80s, the 90s, even in some places into the 2000s that we began to see a real representation, real shifts in representation in African Americans being elected for the first time. And even then, it's very imperfect today, because you know, you strike down one system and then people figure out how to gerrymander or try to manipulate another district as well. But we have a tremendous amount of representation today that we didn't have back in 1965. You look, for example, before the Voting Rights Act, there were about 500 black office holders nationwide. Now there's over 15,000. Yeah. So that's just one example of the kind of progress that's been made because of the Voting Rights Act.
Reading about this ongoing political struggle, decades or, you know, depending on how you look at it, centuries, you can't help but wonder what's underneath it. Like, what is these people's problem that the very idea of a black congressman or mayor or even school board member would engender so much violence and hatred? And at one point in the book, you quote a Louisiana sheriff who says, you know, after the Voting Rights Act, well, maybe it'll be all right as long as they leave our schools and little malt shops alone and as long as they don't marry our daughters. I mean, is that, you know, like, what is the, like, is that at the root of the fear? What's going on?
And that was kind of the moderate reaction.
Yeah.
To the Voting Rights Act. I mean, I think it's always been about trying to preserve white supremacy. That's what it was about before the Civil War. That's what it's been about after the Civil War, that people who believe that they're inferior to another race or people who believe that they should be in power regardless of what the demographics might be, regardless of what the makeup of a place might be, they have always been determined to hold on to power by any means necessary. And they did it in a variety of different ways. I mean, they did it by excluding people from voting at all. They did it by using widespread violence and fraud and intimidation when that didn't work. And they've done it more subtly since then, trying to manipulate laws, trying to manipulate the rules to be able to maintain power. But I think it's I really think that you can't ignore the fact that voter suppression and white supremacy are basically the same, that it's about trying to preserve power for yourself at the expense of somebody else. And that's always what it's been about. And I think it's still what it's about today.
Another group of people who were against the Voting Rights Act and against civil rights in general were people who you would think wouldn't be really that insecure about losing their power in the first place, namely Northern intellectuals. People like William Rehnquist and John Roberts, long before they were on the Supreme Court, as well as some academic conservatives at places like Harvard. What was the objection that these academics and attorneys had to the VRA?
Well, that's a good point, that opposition to the Voting Rights Act really broadened from the kind of just typical Southern segregationist conservative types to more Northern neoliberal kind of neoconservative types. And their opposition was basically to the remedies that the Voting Rights Act required. They weren't opposed to the Voting Rights Act itself, but they kind of wrapped themselves in this mantle of colorblindness, that they were opposed to the consideration of race on, you know, every front. And so they thought that once you started requiring districts to be drawn that favored minority candidates, or once you began busing people to integrated schools, or once you began to do all of those things that were aimed at leveling the playing field, that that was also discriminatory. That, as John Roberts said when he later joined the Supreme Court, that the way to stop it, he said the way to stop discriminating on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Now, I think that's well and good, theoretically, but the problem with that is that, practically speaking, the Voting Rights Act wasn't going to mean much if there wasn't a shift in representation. And the only way, in many cases, to elect an African-American to office was to draw a district that would allow that to happen, because you had a situation all across the country, not just in the South, but in the North, where a lot of whites wouldn't vote for Black candidates or Latino candidates or Asian American candidates. And so you had to consider race to try to get beyond race. And that was something that proved very controversial. In the neoconservative movement, in many ways, the broadening opposition to civil rights in the Reagan era and afterwards was predicated on basically saying that the Voting Rights Act and pieces of legislation like it were well-intentioned, but that the cure had become as bad as the original evil. And that was a very alluring argument to a lot of people, because they didn't think they were racist if they were making it. That they were saying that, in fact, they were the anti-racist, because they were the ones who weren't considering race. And so this was a way to really kill the Voting Rights Act without admitting that you were trying to kill it, and trying to oppose civil rights without actually saying that you were anti-civil rights.
Well, and it seems pretty disingenuous, because, I mean, if people say, well, we believe in the general idea, but not in the remedies. I mean, you've got people like William Rehnquist, who believed that Brown versus Board of Education made the wrong decision. He administered literacy tests, as you've said. And so, I mean, I can't help but think, and I don't know that you would know, you maybe you'd have to ask them, and they probably wouldn't tell you the truth either, but it seems like there is a still, even in these people, some kind of streak of white supremacy going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you kind of have to take it as a case-by-case basis, because I think Rehnquist was much more of an old-school states' rights conservative than someone who might have been at Harvard in the 1960s or 1970s and was more of a neoconservative, someone who started out as a liberal and became more conservative. I think Rehnquist was someone who was very much on the states' rights part of the spectrum. And I always think it's fascinating, because you look at someone and, you know, they're Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but you don't really think about their background. And the fact that Rehnquist had such a controversial background, that you know, he opposed Brown versus Board of Education, and then he administered literacy tests to Black and Latino voters, and he worked for Barry Goldwater, who opposed the Civil Rights Act, and then he really brought with him this states' rights conservatism that was embraced by the Reagan administration. You know, he was put on the court with a very, very conservative, very radical civil rights record. This is kind of how the courts begin to change. This is how thinking about civil rights begins to change. This is how the Republican Party begins to change. You know, the Republican Party was split between people who supported things like the Civil Rights Act and people who opposed things like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. But, you know, over time, the Republican Party is shaped more and more and more by people like Rehnquist, who opposed the civil rights movement, who opposed civil rights laws, and became the kind of dominant, in many ways, even mainstream figures in the Republican Party. And the Republican Party put a particular focus on getting these kind of people on the courts, because they knew that it was going to be very difficult to kill things like the Voting Rights Act via legislation, because they were very popular. So you tried to kill it through the courts as well, and that judges would sit for 40 years, whereas Congresses and presidents would come and go.
All of this gave rise to the Southern strategy of Richard Nixon that played on those Southern fears and attitudes and segregationism and all that. Tell us how that actually worked.
I think the whole idea of the Southern strategy was to be a segregationist without actually seeming like a segregationist, because I think Nixon saw firsthand that Barry Goldwater's opposition to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 proved very costly in the 1964 election. And so you had to be more subtle. You had to be more subtle in terms of appeals to race. And so Nixon wasn't a particularly subtle person, but they tried to refine this strategy to talk about things like states' rights, to talk about constitutionalism, to make it seem like they weren't explicitly talking about race when they were talking about race. And the idea of the Southern strategy was that, yes, the Voting Rights Act was going to lead to a tremendous number of African Americans in the South becoming registered to vote, but there was still going to be a larger number of conservative white Southerners who didn't like what was happening with the civil rights movement, who didn't identify with the changing nature of the Democratic Party, which was becoming more pro-civil rights. And basically, this was a strategy that was initially unveiled by Barry Goldwater, not very successfully, but he said about civil rights that you had to go hunting where the ducks are, meaning where the votes were. And the votes were with conservative white segregationists. And Nixon really took that strategy and dramatically expanded on it to the point where his whole campaign in 1968 was really based on this Southern strategy and talking about states' rights and law and order and these kind of things that were really dog whistles all along. But as I say in my book, one of Nixon's advisors said, basically, it was all about appealing to racism without people thinking they were racist. And that's what the Southern strategy really was. And it ended up being very successful.
As you say, Nixon used the Southern strategy to win, and he won, but he wasn't really, really against civil rights per se, whereas Ronald Reagan really was. Describe to us how Reagan and his administration dealt with the VRA.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think Nixon really had any fixed beliefs. Nixon was someone who supported the Civil Rights Act, who supported the Voting Rights Act, and I don't think he was any great champion of civil rights, but I think he was someone who just saw which way the wind was blowing and it would be his effort to be more oppositional. I think Reagan was more of a true believer. Reagan at the time opposed the Civil Rights Act, opposed the Voting Rights Act, opposed the Fair Housing Act of 1968. As I say in the book, he was really a Westerner who thought like a Southerner when it came to civil rights. And you know, Reagan did something that I think is very, very revealing, which is he kicked off his campaign for president in 1980 in Neshoba County, Mississippi, which is where the civil rights activists Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Michael Schwerner were murdered by the Ku Klux Klan in 1964, the middle of Mississippi Freedom Summer, an event that got a tremendous amount of coverage at the time. And the Neshoba County Fair had always been this hotbed of segregationist sentiment. It was a basically all-white county fair, one of the most segregated places in the country. Confederate flags were routinely flown. This was a place where politicians historically had gone to court the segregationist vote. And Reagan went there in 1980 on the 16th anniversary of the deaths of Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner. And he said, "I believe in states' rights," which had always been the rallying cry of segregationists. And so that was really indicative of what Reagan was trying to do. And they launched an all-out assault on the Voting Rights Act. It was up for reauthorization in 1982. Parts of the Voting Rights Act were temporary and had to be renewed. And the Reagan administration pushed very hard for Congress either to not renew it or to make it as weak as possible. And one of the people who led that effort in the Reagan administration was a young lawyer by the name of John Roberts, who later became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So I always think it's interesting how so many of these figures, like Roberts, got their start in politics by opposing things like the Voting Rights Act. This was really a transformative experience for Roberts and others.
Your book illustrates so well the reality that once you pass a law and enforce it and time goes by, it still doesn't mean that you've solved the problem. And it was shocking to me to read the kinds of Jim Crow-level voting issues that the law was supposed to address that were still happening in the 1980s and even beyond in the South. Describe some of those problems.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Voting Rights Act knocked down a lot of the barriers to being able to vote to representation, but it took a long, long time for some of these discriminatory election systems in particular to be dismantled. And so we talked earlier, for example, about the fact that there were mechanisms set up that just prevented African Americans from being elected. There were at-large elections. If you had a situation where a place was 60% white and 40% black, and all the seats were allocated citywide or countywide, then whites could remain in control forever if they wouldn't vote for any black candidates. And that kind of thing took a long time to challenge through the courts. And, you know, there were a lot of related stuff like that that took a long time to work their way through the courts. At the same time, parts of the Voting Rights Act were temporary and had to be renewed, which meant that every time it came up for renewal, there was this massive fight over whether to renew it. It just so happened that it continually came up for renewal when there were Republicans who were president. So you always worried, would the Republicans at the time sign this legislation? Would Congress have the political will to reauthorize it? And I think one of the success stories of the Voting Rights Act is that it was reauthorized four times by the Congress in 1970, 1975, 1982, and 2006, that all four reauthorizations of the law were signed by a Republican president, passed overwhelmingly with bipartisan support in Congress. And it's just impossible to imagine a situation today where a majority of Republicans would vote for something like the Voting Rights Act and a President Trump would sign it. But that happened for almost 50 years.
And it got stronger each time, as you write about. But at the same time, under President George W. Bush, we got a civil rights division whose purpose seemed to be to undermine the division itself, which I have to say sounds kind of like the EPA of today and other agencies. But what happened? What shifted? I mean, you're kind of talking about the shift between that bipartisan consensus for voting rights and the situation we have today.
Well, I think one of the things that happened was after the 2000 election in Florida, I think Republicans realized that changing election rules or suppressing votes could make a very big difference in close elections. That's really what allowed George W. Bush to defeat Al Gore in Florida, and that there was a political incentive for them to try to do voter suppression tactics, that as African Americans and other minorities went more and more strongly towards the Democratic Party, that if the Republican Party wasn't going to win those votes, then suppressing them could prove very effective. And I think they learned that lesson in 2000, but of course, there was much more incentive to do this after 2008 with the election of the first black president. And Republicans felt like the demographics of the country were slipping away from them, and so they had to make it harder for these people to participate in the political process. I think what happened in the Bush administration was kind of an extension of what happened in the Reagan administration, which is that you had a kind of new generation of people who came up in opposition to civil rights, taking positions of power. And you know, we had seen plenty of efforts in the Reagan administration and the Nixon administration, for example, of people in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which enforced the Voting Rights Act, who were antagonistic to voting rights. But we had never seen so many people who were so ideological appointed to these kind of positions and begin to push out all of the career people who had been defending the Voting Rights Act, mandating compliance with it for generations. And they were pushed out the door, and a whole new breed of right-wing conservatives who really didn't know anything about voting rights went in there. And many of these people are now serving in the Trump Justice Department or serving on Donald Trump's quote-unquote Election Integrity Commission. And so an entire movement of people who were opposed to voting rights really came of age during the Bush administration.
And it's ironic that the Voting Rights Act lasted for so long during so many political changes, and then under the Obama administration was finally gutted by the Supreme Court.
Well, it's ironic, but it also in a way is completely fitting, because what you see throughout American history is that moments of greatest progress are always accompanied by the moments of the greatest assault on that progress. So it's only after the election of so many black candidates during Reconstruction that we see the attacks that lead to Jim Crow. And I think it's at the same time that we see after the election of the first black president, so many of the attacks that then lead to the assault on voting rights that we're witnessing today. So I think there was really just a concerted effort in the Obama era to bring these kind of cases before the Supreme Court, to pass laws all across the country to make it harder to vote, to try to build a consensus within the Republican Party to both pass new voting restrictions and to challenge the Voting Rights Act itself, because I think Republicans saw much more of an incentive to do this kind of thing. And they didn't want a situation where you had the first black president, where you had the first black attorney general enforcing things like the Voting Rights Act very aggressively. And so I think this just became a really important organizing strategy in the Obama era behind the scenes, that if you didn't like the results, you went after all of the things that led to the results or that made that result possible. And so it wasn't like challenging the Voting Rights Act. They just thought of it during the Obama era. I mean, this is something that they've been trying to do for over 50 years, but I think it took on added urgency because Barack Obama was president.
One of the tools, and there are many, that are used to disenfranchise voters in recent years and today has been to purge people's names from the lists of registered voters, and a lot of those people being actually legitimate voters who shouldn't have been purged. Describe what happened in 2000 and 2004 and how that affected the presidential elections.
Well, I agree. I think this had a really big impact on the election, particularly in 2000. It got almost no attention at the time, but Florida was one of only a few states that prevented ex-felons from being able to vote. So even after you had served your time and paid your debt to society, you still weren't able to vote in Florida. And this was actually something that dated back to Jim Crow, when African Americans were far more likely to be given felony charges for things as absurd as looking at a white woman in the wrong way. But anyway, many states had repealed these kind of laws. Florida had not. And what occurred is that the state claimed that all these ex-felons were on the voting rolls and needed to be purged. The problem was that the purge that they did was very, very inaccurate. People were purged based on data that should not have been used. The second thing is that the purge was discriminatory, that African Americans in Florida were 11% of the electorate, but 44% of those who were purged from the voting roll. So people showed up on election day. They were wrongly told they were felons based on false matches, you know, rightful voters being confused with felons, for example, and there was no recourse. And so what happened is after the election, the NAACP sued the state of Florida, and the state of Florida said 12,000 people, 12,000 registered voters were wrongly labeled as felons and prevented from voting. And that number was 22 times George W. Bush's margin of victory in the state, because he only won by 537 votes. So I think a lot of people in the Republican Party drew this very unfortunate lesson that small or not so small manipulations in the electoral process could make a very big difference in close elections. And I think that was really one of the takeaways from the 2000 election in Florida. And we saw a lot of this kind of thing happen once again during the 2004 election in Ohio, which was similarly close, similar battleground. And once again, we're changing the rules of the election, and how election laws were enforced and implemented made a very big difference in a disputed presidential election.
One of the things that happened right after the Supreme Court decision that gutted one of the instrumental sections of the Voting Rights Act was that some states, immediately changed their voting laws. Talk about North Carolina. That seems to be a dramatic example of how voting rights can be expanded and contracted in a fairly short period of time.
So what North Carolina did a month after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act was they passed a sweeping rewrite of their election laws. They required strict voter ID. They cut early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration. They eliminated out-of-precinct voting. My favorite thing they did is they eliminated Citizens Awareness Month,
yeah,
which the state of North Carolina ran to encourage people to register to vote, which you think would be relatively uncontroversial. But all of this was in one bill. And just a month after the Supreme Court got to the Voting Rights Act, and North Carolina was viewed as this progressive state in the South, that it was kind of an oasis of purple in a sea of red. And it had the best election laws in the South and some of the best election laws in the country. And so for it to move back so dramatically, so quickly after the Supreme Court's decision, I think was really jarring for a lot of people. And this law was struck down in July of 2016 by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in a really remarkable opinion, where they said that these laws targeted Black voters with, quote, almost surgical precision, that parts of the law were, the court said, as close to a smoking gun as you'll see in modern times, that the North Carolina legislature requested data on the methods that African Americans used to vote, like early voting, like same-day registration, and they cut or targeted those very methods that had increased Black voter turnout and Black registration. So this was extremely blatant what North Carolina Republicans were doing, and it's really indicative of what Republicans have done all across the country in recent years.
Your book came out before the 2016 election, and that election brings up a dimension that many of us have been watching since 2004, when you had the first election that was mainly done with electronic voting machines. But not enough people, I think, have addressed this, namely the vulnerability of our voting systems, our vote counting systems. In 2000, I mean, you know, everybody knows about hanging chads and butterfly ballots and all the weird stuff that happened in Florida and other places. But now we have this ability for hackers to go into a voting system and change any number of things, you know, to erase names from the voting rolls of registered voters, to flip votes, to change numbers in ways that are hard or impossible to detect. And this can be done by, like, any geek from any country. What is your perspective on the 2016 election with respect to hacking? What do we know? What do we not know? What needs to be done?
Well, I am increasingly alarmed about this because it's emerged since the election that Russian hackers or others were able to access voter registration lists or systems in 21 states. There could be more, we don't know, but they at the very least were able to hack into these systems, at least on a preliminary basis. In Illinois, they were able to steal a bunch of voter data. There's no evidence that any votes were changed in the election, but it's also true that there has not been a forensic analysis of any voting machines used in the election, according to the Department of Homeland Security. So there's still a lot we don't know. And I'm worried about what occurred in 2016, but I'm even more worried about the future, because I think a lot of people believe that the Russian interference was just a first step, that they were fishing around a lot of places to see how vulnerable our system is, which is it's clear that we are extremely vulnerable, and that they're trying to become more sophisticated, and that this is going to get much bigger than just hacking emails. That hacking voter registration systems, first off, without even changing any votes, if you're able to hack a voter registration and change names or delete people or take the system down, that alone would lead to chaos when the votes are actually counted. So you don't even have to change votes. You could just mess around with the registration systems, and that alone would probably have its desired effect. But it's also clear that people could hack into the voting machines themselves. It's a little bit more difficult to do than just sitting on your computer and doing it, but the point is it can be done. And I think this is a real source of vulnerability. There are 14 states which, at least in whole or in part, use electronic voting machines with no paper backups. And that includes cities that have a ton of people, places like Houston, Dallas, Philadelphia. They're voting on voting machines with no paper backups. And you think that at the very least, that should just be required among all 50 states, that you could say, yes, we have a decentralized election system, but every single voting machine in the country has to have a paper backup. Otherwise, we just can't even begin to ensure election integrity. And so this would be, you know, if you were really going to try to focus on the real threats to our election system today, this would be the number one threat you would focus on. But obviously, it's not getting any attention from the Trump administration because they believe they benefited from Russian hacking. It's not getting any attention from most Republicans because they don't think it harmed them in the last election. And so I think we're really taking a very short-sighted and partisan view to a problem that could really affect any candidate and really could affect people's perceptions of the election and indeed the election results themselves.
And the Democrats really haven't done much of anything about all this either. And meanwhile, the current administration and this has been going on for a while, are focusing on the virtually non-existent problem of so-called voter fraud, which has led to voter ID laws that have disenfranchised a lot of people. Why the focus on voter fraud? I mean, it's just basically a red herring.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically that lying about voter fraud is the way to build support for restrictive voting laws. That if you don't present a rationale for such laws, how are you going to get people to support them? And so I think we've had a completely manufactured crisis. Since Republicans have been talking about voter fraud, no evidence of mass voter fraud has emerged. Indeed, barely any evidence of any voter fraud has emerged. I mean, every single election cycle, there is study after study after study about the prevalence of voter fraud. And we see that it's an extremely rare problem in American elections, that there is very little incentive for people to do it. That if you're going to do it, you're more than likely going to get caught. And there are very strict penalties already in place, that it's a felony in many states. It's a big fine in a lot of states. There's jail time. And really what you're doing is at most, you're probably going to flip one or two extra votes. Any sort of massive conspiracy to try to steal an election, more than likely it's going to be very hard to pull off and you're going to get caught either before or after. And so the voter fraud, every single reputable study has shown this is a very small problem in American elections, which leads me to believe that there is another reason that everyone's talking about it so much, which is that if you make this a problem, then you can pursue policies that are more beneficial to your party. And I think if you look at all of the laws that are being passed, whether it's voter ID laws or whether it's cutting early voting or closing polling places or purging people from the rolls, these have been shown to affect Democratic-leaning voters more than Republican-leaning voters, that African-Americans, Latinos, younger people, first-time voters, new voters, low-income voters, they're more likely to not have strict forms of ID. They're more likely to use something like early voting or election day registration, which gets people who are not frequent voters, make them more likely to vote. They're more likely to live in areas that are going to be purged from the voting rolls, or more likely to not obtain documentation they might need to register or to vote. So it's clear that some groups of people are more impacted than others by these kind of laws. And so that's why there's so much focus on this, because one party is trying to gain advantage over another, and you know, talking about voter fraud is a way they try to build that advantage. In the meantime, the very real problems are not being discussed. We're not discussing the fact that a quarter of Americans aren't even registered to vote. We're not discussing the fact that 40% of Americans decided not to vote in the last election. We're not discussing the fact that our registration systems were hacked by a foreign adversary, and we've done nothing to secure our system since then. I mean, those are all the things that you would immediately begin to study if you were worried about election integrity, not mass voter fraud, which just doesn't exist.
You mentioned before, and as you're saying now, it really is a kind of partisan thing that's going on. The Republican Party seems at this point, partly because of changing demographics, not to have the popular support, the number of voters that it needs to win national elections. And so instead of courting the demographics that put Obama in the White House, they disenfranchise them and suppress their votes using all these different methods that you've talked about. It seems like, I mean, you know, looking at the Civil War, Reconstruction, Jim Crow, the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act, no matter what we do, there's a backlash. What do you think needs to happen for us to get past all of this and actually have a country where voting is a right and not a privilege and isn't continually under threat?
I think one big problem that we have is that the right to vote is not a fundamental right in the Constitution. That we have passed many efforts like the Voting Rights Act to try to prohibit things like racial discrimination in voting, to try to give voting rights to women, to people of color, to 18-year-olds, to many groups that have been excluded historically. But nowhere in the Constitution does it say that, you know, everyone should have a right to vote who's eligible and qualified to vote, except for X, Y, and Z. We don't have that kind of basic protection. So what we have is a lot of different laws that are enforced differently on the state level versus the federal level. And voting is just this contentious thing. And that's partly about because we don't have a fundamental right to vote in the Constitution. It's also just fundamentally because voting rights is about power at the end of the day. It's about political power. And those people who are in power are just going to try to get any advantage they can to keep it. And until there's a price to pay for doing that, they're just going to continue doing it. And it's harder to hold them accountable for what they're doing because of the barriers they're erecting, because of the voter suppression laws, because of gerrymandering, because of dark money. All of that stuff just makes it harder to hold people accountable. And so I think it's both the laws themselves, and it's also the political system that incentivizes bad behavior. And my hope is that we would reach some sort of consensus that says that let's debate healthcare, let's debate taxes, let's debate all these things, and let's not debate whether or not people should be able to participate. Let's agree on that everyone should participate, that it's better when more people participate, and then we can have all of these policy debates that are healthy to democracy.
You suggest lots of practical solutions with respect to voting rights, like online voter registration, early voting. I think you've mentioned having a national holiday for Election Day, same-day voter registration. I mean, some of these things, you know, exist, like same-day voter registration or registration updates. Some states are doing automatic voter registration at the Department of Motor Vehicles, things like that. I mean, we could talk forever about money out of politics and the ridiculous length of election cycles and things like that. All of those things are things that people are working on and have been working on. What about that basic shift in attitude? I mean, do you see signs that we can kind of get over the sort of hyper-racialization that this country has been doing for so long, forever?
I mean, I think it's going to be hard to reach any sort of consensus at this point in time, just because there's no consensus on anything. People are so reflexively partisan that one side in particular just seems willing to defend anything that their leaders will do, that it's difficult to sort of see how we're going to come to common ground on voting or anything else. I mean, I think that you kind of just have to keep banging away. And, you know, maybe it's going to be that you pass automatic registration in the states where it's politically possible first, that you do it in Oregon first, and then you do it in California, and then you show that it works, and then maybe you can try to get some like-minded Republicans on board. The governor of Illinois just signed automatic registration. He was the first Republican governor to do so. Part of the reason why he did it is because a majority of the legislature, actually the entire legislature, unanimously supported it. So he knew that if he didn't sign it, his veto would be overridden anyway, but also that, you know, it might be useful for him as a Republican governor in a blue state to support something like automatic voter registration, not seeming like he's going to disenfranchise people. So I think, you know, if the Republican Party, and certainly some Republicans, are looking for an alternative to Trump, looking for some sort of way to distinguish themselves from what we're seeing in Washington today, then I think getting out in front on voting rights is a great way to show that they're a different kind of party. They're not the party that defended, quote unquote, both sides in Charlottesville, that has started deporting Dreamers, that is doing all these other things that are, as you say, are hyper-racialized. But in fact, that if you want to be a party that has a big tent, that is open to new ideas, it's open to different kind of people, then to me, it seems that dropping voter suppression as a organizing principle of your party would be a very good first step.
One of the things I appreciate about your work is that it really challenges our American mythologies about what a great democracy we are. And at the same time, it reminds us that we have those ideals, you know, and we're still trying to get there. And those ideals are embodied in some of the heroes that you write about in the book, like Congressman John Lewis and so many others who fought and are still fighting. I mean, people died for the right to vote. First of all, thank you so much for being with us and for writing this amazing book and continuing to write about this issue in your work as a journalist. And I'd like to recommend that everybody read it. It's called Give Us the Ballot by Ari Berman. And I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
If you want to find out more about Ari Berman and follow his work, you can go to his website, ari-berman.com. On our next program, we're going to be talking about wildfire in our forests with a fire scientist and a firefighter. So check it out this Thursday. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We'd love to hear your feedback, so please email us at feedback@radiocafe.org. Many thanks to the fabulous Dotfoil Computer Services of Santa Fe, providing top-notch computer service, sales, and more on the web at dotfoil.com. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our Northern New Mexico community, and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes and much more content of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.